The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill takes a hack at cryptocurrency. John creates a new federal jurisdiction with his own law enforcement agencies. Maria is awakened at 3 a.m. to respond to a space virus, or a virus going into space, or who knows what. Tom teaches terrorism and traitors, and it takes it to trials. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a wild pitch that could be a home run. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Google has apparently sold their domain name services to an outside company. This core service drove most of the adoption of their other platforms, like G Suite and Google Drive, which means they are killing the goose that laid the Google egg. So much for rich making you smart. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show.
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
We have cameras that have command interpreters in them.
Bill, come on. The Intel chips have an embedded version of Linux that we didn't even know was running in them until recently, right? Well, I say recently, 10, 15 years ago. There's whole embedded operating systems inside the chips.
But we include operating systems where we should not. What we do is we start with an operating system. We put an operating system on a chip, and then we build an application on top of it. But we fail to hide all the functionality of that operating system. So cameras now get included in botnets and are used against us for denial of service mostly, but also for searching for ransomware victims, for digital currency mining.
Yeah, that's the worst. The worst of the worst, in my view, is the digital currency mining, where we are consuming electrical power inefficiently, in some cases using the most inefficient way of generating the power, to generate this electronic sequence of bits, which are ridiculously counted as cash, you know, and it's a Ponzi scheme running on top of damage the environment and consume all the resources.
Right. And where it turns out that we have this digital currency, which was supposed to perform the functions of money, standard of value, medium of exchange, store of value. It doesn't do any of those things. Digital currency is used for speculating with other digital currency traders. It's not used to buy and sell things. So
it's also used to illegally move money to allow for the trade in goods and services that are not legally allowed, to bypass governmental controls, right? That is, at one point, I don't know what it is today statistically, the vast majority of all of the Bitcoin, for example, that was in use for fraudulent transactions and for criminal transactions.
The chain analysis people tell us that it's less than 10% is being used for illegal activities.
Are you including in that all the major frauds that you see from these crashes in the currencies?
No.
Yeah.
That's
okay. Because they've moved on to much larger scale Ponzi schemes. So they've gotten out of those low-level frauds like selling drugs into the big, you know, big-time illegality of stealing gobs and gobs of money. Okay, so much stuff there to unpack. Let's start out with the risk management in the banking system. And both of us today have banking issues that are just pathetic and ridiculous and unnecessary.
Can you give me access to the thing? Oh, no, first you need to do these things followed by these things so you can authorize the thing. It's like, you know, it's not even fun anymore, right? You know,
let's talk through it. So We have specifics, right? We don't have to go generic. Right. We have specifics. So do you want to tell me what's happening on your side of our equation, or do you want me to tell you what's happening on my side of my equation?
Oh, with the Agutera banking accounts? Yeah, just getting access to the app. You know, they put the wrong email address, I think, on my thing. So I got the app working first. But as soon as you turned your access on, it turned mine off. The alerts are going to the wrong place. And you can talk to them on the phone, but they need to send an email to the primary person, who is you, or at least your email account. Who knows, whoever owns that. They don't certainly have any idea. And that authorizes the second user to get the app turned back on. So they promised to send an email, which, of course, didn't get sent.
Well, it might have gotten sent but not received.
Yeah. So swept up the SPM or whatever. It's like, yeah.
And this isn't like something that happened 5 minutes ago. This has been a week or two, right?
Right. Yeah. So this is the world we live in today. It's like I said.
All right. Now let me tell you my story. So every once in a while, I spend money. Now, I understand that's something a bank wouldn't be used to, but every once in a while, I spend money. When I spend money, what I might do is put money into the bank account and then spend out of the bank account. As long as I put money into the bank, they don't usually complain too much. But when I spend money out of the bank account, they decide that's not authorized. So what they do is they call me once with like two rings and then hang up by the time I lift up the cell phone. And they, you know, don't tell me anything. And then they text me a message that says I should call them back. And when I call them back, it's like an hour wait time.
Right.
They won't tell me why. Yeah. They won't tell me why or what's going on. And then they disable my account. But they don't tell me they're going to disable my account. They don't provide me an out. All they say is call us. So now I have to call them during their banking hours, where I'm usually busy doing other things, and spend 15, 20, 30 minutes waiting for them to authenticate me so they can then say, oh, we will now, well, since we've already destroyed the check we were going to send, you now had to go and create another transmission of that resource, which now means that I have to contact the people that I was going to pay the money to on time and tell them it's going to be later because the bank was late. Fortunately, the people I deal with are very nice and generous, and as am I, so we are forgiving to each other. However, you know, it is just pathetic and ridiculous that they don't have tolerance for reasonable. But when I say when people put money into my account, it's no problem, that's strictly not true also.
Right.
Because they stopped me at one point from spending money that was already in my bank account because somebody put more money in my bank account. And They weren't just stopping me from that deposit. They were stopping me from spending anything because that deposit was coming in. Well, excuse me. What? So if you have a problem with the deposit, why are you stopping me from spending the money that was there already? Oh, you know, they don't tell you. So you find out when things start to break and payments don't get made that you thought the money was there for.
You know, and folks, for the record, you know, having capital letters and special characters in a password makes it easier to break. That's not security. You know, none of these real I hate to be too cynical, but I'm sort of with you on this one. So much of the security theater that goes on is not only doesn't serve the purpose, it makes it easier to, you know, for people who want to break into things. And the mechanisms, as we're both complaining here, we get these mechanisms in here for your protection that A, aren't for my protection, B, don't work, C, keep me from using the utility of the actual service that I'm paying you for in the first place.
Yeah, well, they're not for your protection. They're for the bank's protection. And they're not even for that, I'm pretty much convinced.
Right.
because if they did anything like understand the characteristics, behavior of how I behave, they would know that when I'm going to send a check out for $10,000, I'm going to put the $10,000 into their bank account just before I do it, because I'm not going to let $10,000 sit in their bank account all the time.
Right.
And, you know, but they don't understand the behavior of people. And they jump to these conclusions. Their view is they try one time momentarily to contact you, and if you're not right there waiting for them, then they're going to shut everything down.
Well, again, you know, we discussed this a little bit before with coding, and this is the kind of thing where I think machine learning, you know, can help a lot, right? You look at how we do things right now, and you touched on some of these. You know, during business hours, you can get a human being, you can talk to them, and they can slowly, by hand, you can hear the keys clicking, type things into an interface and look up to see what the facts are. And if you have 17 minutes during the middle of your busy day and, you know, after the 40-minute wait, you might get them to figure that out. And this information is all there. And this is the kind of stuff that all this, you know, AI ML that everybody's talking about should be really, really good at automating, right?
So you remember we talked to Doug about this. And the idea that we talked with Doug about was this idea that we could demonstrate that we are who we are without having to tell them all this information. And that's really the problem, because, you know, they wanted all this information about me, like, you know, not my mother's maiden name, you know, that's too stupidly obvious, but they asked tough questions like, which of these is an address you used to live at in Livermore? Like, guess what, guys?
I don't know.
No, I actually do know where I lived, but guess what? By the time you ask the question, somebody can look it up on the internet. It's not quite that hard to find me. So the methodologies that they use to proof these things are poor. You know, they don't meet any standard of care that would be reasonable.
Right. My point is, I understand how they arise, though, right? They arise because doing it without opening up that manhole cover again, right? You know, doing it right is perceived as too much work. So, you know, it's whatever. And at all levels, right? We'll put some blame on the C-suite here, because the first people who come in, you know, talking about cybersecurity and so on and so forth, probably aren't, you know, the best at enunciating that, because, you know, it's early in the industry by definition, and they start adopting some things. They just get built in, and new people come in and they just build on top of that, right? So it just accretes this pile of mess that, you know, to my point about automated systems, like, you think about the actual time spent with these humans. What are they doing? They're clicking away at keys, trying to find, I'm sorry, my computer's slow today. He's spending 37 seconds waiting to pull something up that an automated system would know, I mean, before I finish the first syllable of this rant.
Well, let's be clear, they're using an automated system that doesn't know. But this is where, of course, as consultants, you know, I've made my living, same with Doug and many others that I know, right? So, you know, I've spent a large part of my life going into these organizations, identifying those problems and saying, okay, you know, here's how you fix them.
Yep.
And it takes time, and they fix them. But you're right that every time you fix them, eventually they will get broken again, because they won't be, you know, cared for properly.
It accretes. It just, it lays around.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Wednesday, July 5th, join our free Angel to Exit advisory session. For more details, or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
We're here again with John Tippett. You've done all this other stuff in your career, and now you're starting to get very high up into activities with the government, briefing top-level security programs that are critical national security requirements and have all these sorts of stealth programs and black budgets and so forth. So what happened next, and how did you get involved in which commission?
Well, what happened in 1992 was a three-letter agency came to me. I had been working with them for a long time while I was at Lockheed. And they said, John, we'd like to put you into business and have you support us. And but we just can't afford a long-term endeavor at Lockheed rates, because we know you're not getting the lion's share of that money. So in 1992, April to be exact, I took early retirement from Lockheed. I went next door to Moffett Airfield, which was Navy at that time. And the agency had a small operation there. And I was provided an office, a business card, and I was given a half-man year contract to start the business. Well, it was within a year, well, actually about 6 months, I received another contract from NASA to help manage the transformation of the Moffett Naval Air Station to leave the Navy and become a federal air station. And that had a lot of significant legal issues. That had a lot of significant duties that came along with that. We had to do jurisdictional studies on the entire airfield. And a lot of people don't know this, but Moffett Naval Air Station, located in Sunnyvale, basically, is a huge place. But there's an auxiliary naval air station that is owned by Moffett that's out in Patterson, California, which is in the Central Valley. And it operated in tandem with Moffett in a lot of the Navy operations. So it took about 2 years. That contract lasted 2 years. And some of the things that we had to do to make that work, NASA had never supervised federal law enforcement. So they didn't have a clue. They weren't even eligible to do it. So we had to find a senator that would sponsor a bill in Congress that would grant law enforcement authority to NASA. We did that.
What senator was that?
I forget his name, but he was a Mississippi senator.
It didn't matter where the senator was from, just find one.
Certainly, I didn't go to the phone book. You know, that was something that the Department of Navy, the CIA, and the Department of Defense all participated in those things. I did write up the jurisdictional study for the naval property. There are four levels of federal jurisdiction, and we had all of them in this property. And each one of them talks about the sharing of responsibilities, who gets to tax what in terms of depending on what level it is. So then, because of federal statutes, NASA had to develop a police department because now the Naval Military Police Department was leaving. They didn't have any police. There was a substantial amount of the base that was exclusive federal jurisdiction, which means the state has no rights, has no access other than what they give permission to access. What's on that base is not taxed by the state. So it was a challenging effort. We did a lot. They didn't know. They had no lawyers on staff. They were all contract lawyers. They didn't have any lawyers that understood criminal justice. As it turns out, we found a woman who worked in the staff judge advocate's office of the Navy who was retiring, and she was a criminal attorney. And so NASA hired her as the what would amount to the city attorney of other jurisdictions. So she became the attorney that would administer law enforcement, the justice program.
You had federal judges would be the judges involved, right?
Well, I had a federal judge that after I wrote the report that outlined what we were going to do, I had him review that to make sure, one, that it was legal, and secondly, that it made sense, you know, and wasn't challengeable on legal grounds.
Yeah, well, so the point here is if you had a crime, for example, your prosecution would have to take it to court, and the court would be the federal court in your jurisdiction.
Right, exactly. Well, and the other thing, Moffett Field had buku housing for military people. And so that meant you had civilian populations on the base, and that meant there were kids on the base. Well, under federal law, there's no such thing as juvenile justice. There are no federal laws that cover kids. And so we had to devise a mechanism to work with the state attorney general in order to provide that coverage. And that one took some time because there were a lot of jurisdictional issues, and But it turns out that the Department of Justice, it took a while to find this, but we did, that the Department of Justice had a standard memorandum of agreement that when we first asked each of the regional USAs,
U.S. attorneys, yeah.
Yeah, U.S. attorneys, about such a thing, none that we talked to knew anything about it. So I flew back to Washington, went to the Department of Justice, and said, I want to talk to a bunch of old guys.
Somebody who knew it from before.
Yeah, yeah.
They said, oh, wait a minute, I remember. I have one of these.
And lo and behold, we found an old guy that actually had used this in a couple of different jurisdictions. So,
I have just the thing for you, John. Developed in 1723.
Well, I got to tell you, after we finished the Moffett Field Project, NASA had me go to all of their centers and do jurisdictional studies. That had nothing to do with cybersecurity, so I'll leave that out.
There you go. Let's just start out with he went back into the Navy. He was not in the Navy. He was in the Army. So what branch of the service was he in? Well, his rank was classified. You know, maybe his branch was classified too. Well, I was brought in this way. All right. I just, you know, you start to listen to the, you know, you'll never hear the full story. I've known John for a long time, and I always learn things from him. And then you talk about, you know, 11, 12, however many commissions he's on, largely related to secrecy and the classification system and all these things. And, you know, if at first you don't succeed, you know, just like you said, he just keeps pushing that rock up that hill.
Well, you know, I think I was thinking about intellectual property control, you know, listen to what John's talking about in that case, right? You know, and one of the things I'm sort of on my plate right now is to help people understand how we're doing it now, how we've always done it, you know, to John's point about, you know, how we're national security and intelligence and secrecy managed at that point to a certain level. You know, everything's fractal. You can handle it more and more detailed, and we do today. You know, the U.S. federal government, it, you know, has a higher maturity level in handling all that today. But the intellectual property issue...
I'm unconvinced that we're better at it today.
Yeah. But as a comparison, the intellectual property issue came up in threat intelligence, you know, 10, 15 years ago when threat intelligence was the big thing in cybersecurity. We was talking about, well, if I share this information, the bad guys, my competitors, whatever... And again, in supply chain security these days, software bill of materials, I hear this all the time, right? The intellectual property. But if I share this, you know, software composition information, isn't that A, giving away all my competitive advantages and telling the competitors everything? And you have to look at, like, how do we do intellectual property control now? You work for a big corporation. You're working, you know, with partners and so forth. You're being circumspect as far as you know, and probably more or less following the rules of, you know, sharing intellectual property that we're agreed on. But you don't really know that. So it turns out controls are hiring the right people and hoping they do the right things to date.
So you know of the recent information on the case of the woman from Coca-Cola, right?
Not sure. What's that one?
Well, apparently her thing was not the formula for Coke, but the formula for the coatings inside the cans.
Ooh.
And the coatings inside the cans are what keeps the Coke from eating away the cans.
Right.
And China's cans, the Coke eats them away.
Right.
And so she, you know, was from China, or she was a U.S. citizen, you know, but, you know, she had whatever relatives or something in China, or she was born in China, whatever the deal is. And she had all the characteristics. If you listen to the things she did and compare it to the stuff that Walker did and the stuff that Hansen did and so forth, all the same stuff, you know, that you see it again and again, right? All the signs are there, but the people don't know how to interpret it. And she goes from company to company to company doing this. And there are always exceptions for her because she's the best and brightest.
Yep.
And the management response is always inadequate. There's no standard method of responding from management perspective. All these challenges that you see in company after company after company. there's this movement, right? The information needs to be free movement, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's virtually impossible to keep anything completely secret so that nobody knows about it. And at the same time, it's virtually impossible to have everybody know about something.
It's called Mayfield's paradox.
Right. Well, yeah, as security people, you know, this sort of same old, you know, it can be frustrating and so forth. But I think, you know, the positive message from this, you know, a lot of people are overwhelmed. You know, there's more and everything, and sooner or later we're bound to get overwhelmed with the thing. I don't think so. I think we were overwhelmed to begin with. We've always been overwhelmed. You know, it's not much different than it's always been, right? We have, you know, we still wake up and spend this many hours awake during the day, and we wrestle with problems, you know, that are about the same. You know, security isn't going to get a lot better, right? You know, that's not a, you know, but it's.
Well, so when you say a lot better, I think there are some fundamentals here. It's not about better or worse, it's about risk management.
Right.
If you listen to my discussions with Bill Murray, he said, you know, he was giving a talk at Naval Postgraduate School and I was in the audience. And every time he'd come up with something, I'd say, yeah, but here's how you can get past that. And same thing, right? When I was young, you know, I found flaws in everything and I still do. But he had gotten to the point where he reconciled the fact that that's its nature. And now I've gotten to the point where I've reconciled that that is its nature. They're just, you cannot perfect it ever.
Right.
What you can do is reasonably and prudently make decisions and manage risk.
Yep.
And which is the right thing to do. I guess one of the challenges is how do we change the culture of security to where instead of being brutal and punishing people and trying to force them and push them into things that they don't want to do, you find ways of supporting what they do want to do and having enough protection so that the harm isn't so great compared to the benefit you get from the person.
You know, stealing from Terry Pratchett as always, you know, it's funny that we're always dragging people kicking and screaming instead of leading them calmly by the hand, right? You know, I find, we talked about this in a previous segment, you know, alignment of interest, policy hacking and alignment of interest, you know, look around, who are the stakeholders? What do they want? What are they trying to achieve, right? You know, align with that. And in cybersecurity, in a business environment or anywhere a budget is involved, economics count. And you can't roll your eyes at it because it's stressful. People are responsible for signing off on a budget and getting it done and that blah, blah, blah. And if you can walk in there and say, I can make your life a little bit easier, and oh, by the way, you'll be more secure, which will also make your life easier, that's a win. Bludgeoning only works, you know, bludgeoning is sometimes necessary. Regulations are sometimes necessary, but that's got to be the exception. You got to try for, you know, alignment.
So the inflexibility of the large enterprises, obviously for good reason, they're inflexible because, you know, they have very high volume and you just can't make everything exceptions. But I was recently implementing an interface to ChatGPT or whatever the name of the engine is internally with some of the tools that I have. And I wanted it to run so that it all runs from the browser. So from your browser, you load my tools in your browser by clicking on the link. And from then on, you never talk back to my infrastructure. So I don't know anything about what you're doing, all the privacy in the world. Turns out the tool cannot contact ChatGPT that way because there's a security restriction against cross-site scripting, right, which prevents it from running software on my site that then accesses things on another site like the ChatGPT interface, right, the API. So now it has to come back to my infrastructure. Not only that, the key that allows you to spend money has to be sent from my infrastructure. It can't be sent from the browser. So I have to get the key. So I don't want the key. I don't want to know about it. I don't want to have to deal with it. So now I have a process that audits things or that keeps logs of what's happened. And now I have to figure out a way to make that one not log so that I don't have a copy of that key. The security mechanism designed, you know, for a beneficial purpose also inhibits the beneficial purpose.
Right.
I think it's a lack of reasonable foresight. People that do this, they always are thinking about themselves and where they are, and they're not reflecting on the implications for others. I'll give you another one. This is the challenge that we have. So I have a lot of accounts for different small businesses because I work with a lot of companies, and you need to keep them separated from each other. And so they each have different accounts. So just in my web browser, I cannot be logged into more than so many accounts at a time. And a couple of years ago, I hit that threshold. So now I have two web browsers running in different browsers, so they don't know about each other. And that gets me more accounts, but of course they don't interact well. Well, I've now run out of that. So it's like, so now I'm looking at, you know, anonymous windows and, you know, windows that don't know about each other, and just the inconvenience level keeps driving up. And Bill Murray also said this wonderful thought. It's that security always loses out to convenience. And the problem is security seems to be winning over convenience, and the security load is therefore expanding to the point where it's intolerable and people are starting to struggle against it. And that's why, you know, the enterprise used to say, well, you need to use our phone, our cell phone for our business. But people just said, I'm not carrying around two smartphones. And so that's the end of that. So the enterprise lost control. So now they want to put stuff on my smartphone so it controls what I do. And you know, and all it does is make it harder and harder to get things done. It slows everything down. And, you know, you grind the system to a halt when you put sugar in all the gas tanks. And that's what security is doing.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree on a lot of the reality of that. But, you know, my posit, you know, is that it's, you know, let me share a war story with you, right? You know, so the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, your posit is that, you know, consider, you know, we need more people considering the ramifications of what they're doing. And I'm going to come back to, you know, the short answer of kind of no. We need some, but the fact is that most people are just trying to solve their own problems. But in this case, you know, so I was running the PIX team, the PIX firewall at Cisco in late 98, and we had, can't begin to go on about the number of problems. Everybody hated us. The executive team had end of life and everything else. We're trying to manage this partner relationship that was handled badly, and decided to cancel it. Cancel the entire thing after a year, I think 2 years of promising any minute now to deliver this VPN capability to the third party in the Cisco PIX. And I agonized over this email to the field, which is thousands and thousands of people all over the world, all of whom, you know, it was a big issue too, and wrote a page long note that said, I'm trying to consider, to my long winded point here, you know, all the stakeholders involved and you're all out there. So here's my personal contact information. I take personal responsibility. You know, we're going to give away free stuff to do this thing until such point, you know, 8 months from now when we actually do it ourselves and deliver on it. And I got like 300 angry responses out of, say, 10,000, maybe 20,000 recipients. And I finally hauled one up and I said, let's get on the phone. I want you to read my words back to me. Right. And it was the tone of voice that the words were read in that made him think that I, you know, I had said, don't call me. It's your problem. Go away. So it's just, my point is, it's just very, very, very complicated, you know, to really do a diligent job of thinking of all the impacts of things. So what we see, and you're right, you know, security has become its own problem, which our community has to deal with. But that's why things are done the way they are, because you can't, you know, someone's just trying to make the thing print, right? So they make it print, and they didn't think that they should, you know, actually check how many characters are in the input, right?
There's nothing wrong with make the thing print. The problem is that after you make it print, then you have to go back and fix all the things you did to make it print that got around the mechanisms that should normally be in place so that it still prints. And that's what I spend, I'd say 90, well, certainly 80%+ of the time I spend in writing code has to do with, okay, I finally, you know, took enough stuff out of the way so it worked, and now I have to put it all back in. You know, because the actual doing of the, you know, of the stuff, whatever the stuff is, that's just not that hard. The thing that's hard is doing it in a manner that fits with everything else. You know, that's one of the reasons we have so many so-called security problems. I do want to just notion here that security is misinterpreted as confidentiality. And the so-called sophisticates in it say, you know, confidentiality, integrity, and availability, usually in that order, which is to say we'll break it rather than be able to use it. And, you know, there's more to it. It's not CIA. You know, there's also accountability and transparency and use control and so forth. And these other factors are, you know, the value that you bring is in assuring the utility of these mechanisms that we're creating. And the security's job is not to keep things secret, or at least it shouldn't be. The job should be to assure the utility of the mechanisms, you know, against malicious and accidental events. And it's that misinterpretation, that misdirection that causes a lot of these problems.
Yep.
Wednesday, July 5th, join our free Angel to Exit advisory session. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Maria, who is one of the early women in the cyber world. She's had an amazing career starting as a programmer, and well, let's see where she goes from there. Maria, welcome back.
Thank you, Fred.
All right, so you got hired for your documentation and meticulous attention to details.
Yep.
But then what?
So here I was, about 27 years old, you know, had most people's dream jobs, right?
So hang on, this was like 3 years ago? What?
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. It was a while back. I'll date it right now. We were working on, really the backbone of the internet had just come up between NASA, the NASA space centers like Goddard down at Johnson Space Center and University of Illinois at Urbana, Berkeley Labs, to name a couple places that were.
Yeah. The internet or the ARPANET at that point?
The ARPA. Yeah. It, moving into the internet. We were actually on the migration team. So that's actually what I got hired to do. And I worked at the NAS facility, which is a numerical aerodynamic simulator, which was really the location of all of NASA's supercomputers. So we were asked to network the supercomputing center. So all these educational institutions of higher learning, as well as the other NASA's facilities, could all use this resource that was in Mountain View, even though, you know, Goddard is in Maryland,
Remote access to the high-powered computer.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. So that's where I was working. My first assignment was to network the Crays. Remember those things?
Yeah.
Well, the Cray computers, the sure. Plasma cooled Cray systems. And so I was coding in Unix. I probably might have written the first printer spooler for Unix machines.
Oh, it's your fault. That Unix had the worst for the longest time, you know.
Okay, you can blame me for that. I believe I was
right, that's
the
your
first
fault.
One.
Okay, now I know.
Yeah. I
come up to my house, we're going to talk printer spoolers, and you're going to have to get my printers to work for computer. That's
so that was like one of the things one of the first things I worked on. So here we are, you know, we finally got it, everything up and running and networking and across the country. It was quite a feat, right? It was like 1987, the end of 87. And then 1988 hits and nobody's ever heard of cybersecurity. Although there was a gentleman back at University of Southern California that had coined a term called computer virus.
Yeah, I don't know why we ever call that guy a gentleman, but okay, moving right along.
The next thing you know, it's 3 a.m. in the morning, and I can't remember the exact date now, but I get a call from my boss. You know, back then we all had landlines and pagers, right? So the pager's going off, but I'm sleeping. I'm not going to answer that stupid thing. And
So the whole purpose of the pager was for you to call him, but you said, I'm like,
yeah, you know, call her. It's just her.
That's not going to happen.
And so she finally calls and I pick it up. And she goes, you need to come in right now. And I'm like, look at us, like 3 something in the morning. I'm like, are you kidding me? Lucky I didn't live that far. I just lived on the other side of 101 from Ames Research Center.
Okay, so you had to drive across.
I drove in and she's all, what's going on? She goes, we're infected. And I'm like, infected by what? Myself and then our other, another.
And you called me in to get infected as well?
Yeah.
What's going on? It's a pandemic. Oh, no.
It hadn't been called anything except for a computer infection, right? On Unix machines, it targeted the Sun 350s and the Silicon Graphics machines. So anyway, long story short, the first awesome cybersecurity response team was formed in that very moment. And our brilliant response was, how fast can we run and pull out all the...
Yeah, turn it all off. Yeah, yeah.
Unplug it all. That's exactly what we did. So we ran around Ames building 2. It's a big building.
The problem with unplugging it all is if it hasn't gotten there yet, that's fine. But if it has gotten there, unplugging it just makes it harder to undo it, right?
But we didn't know where it was and where it wasn't. Remember, there were no analytics, no analytical tools. Yeah. There was no network monitoring. There was Cisco wasn't even a company with routers and switches. Remember this?
Yeah. They were hubs, right?
They were hubs. Yeah. There is no.
I wrote an article on changing over from hubs to switches.
Yeah.
Back sometime in the 1990s.
Oh, send that to me. I'd like to, nostalgia it's on, there.
It's on all.net. Just have to.
So then after we unplugged everything and the supercomputers were different because we actually had to do stuff to bring, especially the crays, right? You just can't unplug a cray. And there's another machine.
Called boil and break, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the cooling goes off. Don't want to do that.
There was another machine called the connection machine. Ever heard of this?
Oh, I remember the connection machine.
Yeah. And then we had a bunch of Amdahls there. And several other types of machines there. But anyway, yeah, so those had to be brought down. And I was in charge of those. So I brought those down. And then the next thing, it's just like, now you're looking at 7-8 in the a.m. in the morning. And it's just like, now what? What's going on?
Yeah, now so, everybody's ready to show up for work. And now all the computers are down.
So, now it's just meeting to see, what happened. And of course, the 3-letter agencies all get involved in all this stuff because it was an attack against the government, right?
That's
right. So as days went by, we isolated one of the machines, and one of his name is Gary Viem. He actually took the virus. I think they found the guy, but we at the time didn't know. We just knew we didn't like him very much because he kept us up for days. And most of us wanted to wring his neck. But we reverse engineered it. And then slowly, we actually developed and documented very well a plan for starting at Ames, how to scrub a machine, re-image it, right? And then bring a machine up at a time. It took a long time.
And nowhere during that process did you even consider calling me for assistance, right?
I wish I would have known you.
No, but I'm just saying, because my consulting fees at the time were much lower than they are now.
It
would have been less expensive than all those days. On the other hand, in that time frame, usually when they called me, it was out of suspicion that I had done it. So it was better they left me alone.
That feeling when your own past starts feeling like a Bletchley Park World War II drama, right? The Ames Center probably in the same room, given the time, or maybe different anyways, but there was the mainframe room, the supercomputer room, which was for the Apollo program and was then refurbished. And when a friend of mine gave me a tour there, maybe around the turn of the century, it was a backup system room. But I have a paper disc because in the hallway there, they, being a good government facility, was built in the 50s and never renovated, right? And there's a little just outside the that main computer room for that gray might have been. There's a set of old sort of filing cabinet things with paper discs on them with a red and blue pen that tracked the temperature over 2 weeks in the computer room. So I have one of those discs. I picked up one when I was there. There's a whole pile of them sitting there looking at the little bumps. And you could tell when I always, thought that this might be a good retirement puzzle, right? Do a FOIA request, find out what was happening on those days. What programs were running in that room? Why is the temperature going up? Simulating the lunar lander or whatnot.
This is a covert channel. Here she is. Okay, I was brought in to program this. Happened to be that she was in charge of all the supercomputers in the supercomputer center by now, a year or two later, and now the Morris worm, I guess it is, comes along And all of a sudden, she's running the first computer emergency response team and documenting it well. So now she's basically, you know, head of the non-military version of the, you know, computer emergency response team for the federal government. Yeah. Oops.
Isn't that the backstory of so many folks, you know, from that era, from our era, right? You know, it's like, how do you end up being involved in this? Right. And think about Maria, you know, we worked together, you know, we both got to Cisco in 98. And so in that period, yeah, the product cert, you know, was sort of just a thing. You know, something happened, somebody emailed somebody else, and all of a sudden there's a P-cert, right?
Well, yeah, it all sounds like, from the outside, it seems very different from how it seems from the inside. Because, you know, she was the one that was called at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
It's like, what? You know, I love it. She had a pager, but she's not going to answer that at 3 o'clock in the morning. So they call her on the landline, right? Her boss calls her on the landline and says, Maria, get in here. What? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Is this like an initiation thing? What's going on? No, come here.
And as I've said many times, right, I find a lot of comfort in this, right? You might think that there's some big organization out there running things and has it all figured out. And no, a lot of the things in the software bill of material world and the supply chain world right now, every week I attend these working groups and I lead some of them, and we're all just, I don't know, figuring it out. You know, and then there'll be documents and publications and standards and people will get training and so forth. They'll say, this is the way it's done. You know, they must have done this. There is no they. It's just Maria in the mid 3 o'clock in the morning, and one thing leads to another.
Yeah, and that's right.
That's
competent
fine.
People, smart people, you know, they get called in because that's who they are, because the people know them and they're there. I have to say, in a lot of the early days of the virus world, when bad things happened, people called me up. And I didn't like being called at 3 a.m, so I stopped that. But they call you, you know, okay, sure. I mean, I've flown to Canada and Europe and other places on an urgent basis just because somebody said, oops. So I just think I love to hear these stories because that's, you know, how everybody gets from where they are to the next step up. You know, you're competent, you know what you're doing, you're thoughtful, you're hardworking, you're good at what you do, and then you happen to be at the, either we could call it right or wrong place at the right or wrong time, but it's the place and the time where the world changes, and there you are changing the world.
Right. And as a matter of advice, you know, people listening out there, you know, it's, don't feel bad if you pass some of those opportunities up. That'll happen too. You know, the characteristic is, are you generally willing to make that step? And are you willing to think about that?
Willing and able. Yep. Luck favors the prepared.
Exactly.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement, and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers.
You got to listen to this story. After Larry DeNardis basically left the presidency and they brought that idiot in as their president, okay? I don't care. He's a full-fledged idiot. I was concerned that, number one, I was getting too much power. And I said, what are you talking about? I'm not even on campus. I'm going to California all the time and various places, and we're making money. And he said, well, we've got to check. And so he checked with the CFO, and the CFO said, it's the only program we've got that's making money. And so the next year, he said, well, I don't know. I think we're going to have to close that California program. I said, are you out of your mind? We close that California program, you're going to lose a lot of money. And so he basically said, no, I want it closed. I said, I'm telling you, if I close it, I'm not going to basically reopen it, because I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. You're going to be told by George, the CFO, that there's really a money leak now. And sure enough, that's what happened. I closed it. And then within 4.5 months, he called me over and said, Tom, can you start it up again? I said, what part of this whole conversation that we had that missed your ability to understand? So, no, I'm not going to. In fact,
because the licensing and accreditation took years.
So what I decided to do was basically say that I'm leaving. And so in 2008, I left the University of New Haven. I retired after 14 years service there. And I just basically was getting tired of all the flying and all of the junk that was going on. And thing that I did was I went to, for 3 years, I created that forensic data center.
Well, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's go back in time again. So now it's time to talk about the program at Sandia. So let's talk about, have the Sacramento program running, national security and forensics, including digital forensics, right?
Yeah, and in the national security program that I had operating on the Sandia campus, okay?
Well, let's start with how you created that.
Well, I had the master's degree in national security, and then basically I decided, my gosh, you know, it might be a good idea if we actually got more involved with the community. So I decided I was going to go out to New Mexico, and I met with the people and discussed basically whether or not there was any interest in a master's degree in national security. And they said yes, but there's another campus. Why don't you offer it at this other campus in Albuquerque? And I said, no, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it through the University of New Haven, and I'll just commute again, and we'll hire people. And that's when we got Tippett involved, and we got a lot of people involved in that thing. And the interesting thing, when I talked to one of the people, the lady who was in charge of all academic programs for Sandia, I met with her, and she said, well, it sounds like it might be an interesting program, but I don't know. Why don't we do this? Why don't you send me a listing of what the courses are? And then we'll just basically post it on the board, and we'll see if we can get people interested. And she said, how many people do you need? And I said, well, we need to actually cover all expenses and make a modest profit. And she said, well, you know, most of our programs, when we start something like this, we'll get maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 people that show an interest in it. And then if they start the program, they might get 11, 12, 13 in it, and that's about it. And so I sent her the stuff, and I said, here, you can post this. She called me the next day. She said, I can't believe this. We had, at this meeting, we had over 300 people attend.
300?
Yeah. And she said, you know, I couldn't answer any of the questions. I wish that you were here, but I didn't ask you to come out because I thought we'd only get 5, 6, 7 people show up. So I didn't think it would be worth your while. So she said, yes, it's clear that we want this program. So let's get started on it. So that's how we got started on it. And of course, again, once again, you played a fundamental role in this whole area because of your expertise and help in the national security and the computers. And then we decided we were going to go from the Sandia campus to Livermore. And that's when it really was great. And we really were able to get a lot of people. And because of that, we had established a national security program that had tentacles into the professional national security environment at Sandia Labs and at Livermore Labs. and no one has ever done that before that point in time. But it was just a function of the fact that I meet a lot of people, and there's a lot of people that help out, and because I can share an idea, but basically ask them for more, like in your case, you know, I asked you for help, and you basically said, well, you know, you could do much more if you did X, Y, and Z. And I said, that's a great idea. So so we did.
So we start with Tom calling an idiot and then declaring clearly that no, he means it. And yes, you can say it. I decided rather than taking the word idiot out, I would just take out the name of the person and, you know, no problem.
Well, yeah, trust and transparency. Yeah, I don't know the individual involved, but from the story, I think they earned, you know, maybe they grew, maybe they learned, but at that point, no, that's idiot work. But I love that you, and I love the 300 people showing up, right? You know, and again, as we're discussing it here, you know, existing, you know, stable structures like academia, you know, can get a little Silicon Valley, can get a little cyber when you spin it right, right? National security with a cyber twist. And knowing you, and I know the program involved, right? You know, put that sort of interest in it, and yeah, people will actually show up for it. It's not dentistry.
Well, I think it's fascinating because it's at a national laboratory. So one of the things Tom is in many ways brilliant at is aligning with a customer base, right? So, I mean, you know, national laboratory is probably the right place to give a master's degree in national security, right? Because, you know, that's what the laboratory is all about. And so then, sort of simultaneous with that is, you know, he creates a wonderful program for the right audience at the right place at the right time. But also, if you look at the time frame here, national security was not viewed in a very positive light in the United States in the 1960s and 70s and 80s and 90s. But after, you know, 9/11, it became something, you know, much, much bigger. So if you look at the actual timing of when this took place, the Sandia Livermore campus opened up in 2002, in January. And I know that because I was working at Sandia until that November when they decided that they no longer wanted me working there. And so, you know, I had the College Cyber Defenders in a building in one area of the place that was for unclassified work. And the new classes from University of New Haven started up a couple weeks after that. So as I, you know, a month and a half later, I'm across the hall from where I just was, you know, teaching the people who I used to work with at the National Labs, as well as all sorts of other people about, you know, national security issues. So, you know, I think there's a certain brilliance in the way Tom does things that's, you know, it would not have happened if he didn't have this wonderful set of people he was working with. I mean, he talks about me very nicely, but, you know, the truth is these other folks, you know, they're much further up in the national security establishment, you know, much more the trusted parties than I ever was in that establishment. I was more hated and reviled than loved, endeared to.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, when we talk about John Tippett, you know, obviously, he has had his challenges in dealing with other people, but always because he was doing his job. I think there, hopefully, there's a certain respect that comes from that, but maybe you don't get any Christmas cards.
Yeah, you know, I like arguing things out, right? You know, I seek out contentious but intelligent people, right? Because, you know, if nothing else, I enjoy it, but I've quite often been wrong. I've been fervently wrong. I've been wrong about things I believe, you know, very much so, right? So I, for one, appreciate I like both sides of it, right? Yeah, you know, Tom's approach is exactly right. If you really want to get things done, you need to be more than right. You need to be savvy. You know, understand how these things work and understand, for example, that education requires money, that nonprofits and colleges and so on and so forth, you know, have budgets, and that has to come from somewhere. And that's, you know, if you can hack, you know, Tom is a true hacker. Right. He's been hacking the systems to get things done, you know, for decades.
I guess I can just agree with you there.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill starts to take advantage with passkeys. John gets commissioned, and we still don't know what service he was in.
Maria gets to the edge of space. More fraud, spies, and lies, and another pitcher goes to bat. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string-beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.